about gap estimates. And I have to stress that this is joint work over the years with Tom Michul, Bruno Nachtigall, and Shannon Starr. And so the focus in the end will be gap estimates, a certain method called the Martingale method. But first, let me just give you an introduction. How do I get to these things? And I come from a different point of view, but in the end, it comes down to the same stuff. All right. So my motivation comes from looking at a magnetic sample. This is our magnetic sample, and you have suppose we have a sample where we have a magnetization. So we have certain domains. So we have a domain where the magnetization in this direction, then the opposite, and then there is some magnetization in this direction. And suppose this is given to us. And now you come, there are some classical experiments. Now you come with an exterior magnetic field, and you're going to drag this at the cost of your paramagnetic field. And then certain domains will grow at the cost of others. Others will shrink. Right? And if you do this long enough, and the magnetic field is strong enough, so in the end you have created a ferromagnetic, sample. You have totally magnetized this thing. So these lines here should indicate that there's a domain wall in between, which is thin compared to the area here. So these are some classical experiments, and you want to understand this from a microscopic point of view. So here I have plotted a one-dimensional scenario. So I have here, say, to the right, I have all my spins pointing in this direction, and to the left, I have all my spins pointing in the down direction, and there is some interface. They go from up to down, and here I have this point A. This is one of the this is a one-dimensional interface, and I want to describe the motion of one-dimensional interfaces. And so, how can we do this in a microscopic model? And once you get an idea of how to do this, you want to understand more quantitatively how a domain wall is actually moving in terms of the microscopic interaction. How does it depend on the coupling constants of your Hamiltonian, your microscopic Hamiltonian? How does it depend on the magnetic field, temperature, etc.? So that's the original problem. So again, I have here, just let me point out, I have here one domain wall, which goes through the point A, and I have another domain wall here dashed, which goes through the point B, and then I want to move it from A to B, by you're not destroying shape, I think, by keeping the shape, but just moving it from here to there, and I'm gonna apply a magnetic field, which is initially localized around this point, which points in the x direction, so to rotate this magnetic field. And at the end of the day, and then this, I move this magnetic field from here to there. And at the end of the day, my domain wall will be here. And if I do this slowly enough, adiabatically, I will be close to this state. So I can move domain wall states. That's what I want to do. And now I so far I haven't said what Hamiltonian I'm going to use, but I will denote the Hamiltonian by capital H. And it was realized some 10 years ago that that a certain one-dimensional, that the Heisenberg model, the ferromagnetic Heisenberg model, has domain wall states, this interface states, as ground states. That's very convenient. So there is a model, the ferromagnetic Heisenberg model, which has ground states which look exactly like these domain wall states. That was realized some 10 years ago. So, and then once you have this, you can ask about dynamics of these interface states.
Why isn't the ground state just all the spins up?
Okay. You will see the model, and I will create some interface boundary. It depends on the boundary conditions. So that also led to the characterization of all finite and infinite volume ground states of the one-dimensional Heisenberg model. That's a byproduct. But it's true, you have those and you all bounce, but you also have these interface states. Okay. And by V of t, I'm going to denote the magnetic field, which will depend on time. So my time evolution will be the time ordered exponential of h plus this, so this is Heisenberg, and then I add the magnetic field. You do the exponential, time order it, and that will be your time evolution. And you want to see if you do this slowly enough, then in the end you will have your domain wall moved from A to B. That's the thing. There's two points I want to stress, and then I'm going to move to the Martingale method. Okay. So as I said, you want to do this slowly. So at some point you want to apply the adiabatic theorem. So applying the adiabatic theorem, well, you need to know something about the gap, or you want to control how fast does this actually move? How long do we have to wait? Polynomial, exponential, long time, or something like this. And the problem is in real life, in real life, this domain wall may stretch over a lot of sites. I didn't know that I'm going to be recorded, so I put it 100, but we should think 20 or so. It's already large size, right? So 2 to the 20 is the dimension of your Hilbert space. So a domain wall may stretch over a lot of sites. So how on earth are you going to ever do this numerically, right? I mean, you prove something. You apply the adiabatic theorem. Say, if you wait long enough, then it's close. And then you want to do some numerics. You want to see how does it really work, right? And if you have a lot of sites, you can't just do the exponential, obviously. But there is a more advanced numerical scheme, which is the time-dependent DMRG. So DMRG stands for Density Matrix Renormalization Group Method. And it was 2 or 3 years ago that Vidal implemented a time-dependent DMRG method. Mm-hmm. And we started from scratch, and we have implemented this DMRG algorithm for our Heisenberg model, and you know, to see how it actually works. And you can make it work even with MATLAB. So and even though you're not a computer scientist, I mean, but it works very well, this DMRG. Okay, so that's all about the initial problem I'm interested in. So now I want to talk about question.
Talk about a gap. I mean, you don't have a gap, I suppose there are spin waves or something like that.
Right. In my case, I will have a gap. So it's just the ordinary adiabatic theorem with a positive gap. And I mean, there's cases where you don't have a gap, and then the numerics is more difficult and the analysis is more difficult. So I don't know. But in this one-dimensional case, I do have a gap. Okay, so I want to say a little bit background on the Martingale method. You should not think that this was my method. So the Martingale method, in the context of quantum spin system QSS, and not for general ones, but for a certain class of quantum spin system, those who are frustration-free, and I will tell you what I mean by frustration-free quantum spin system, the Martingale method was introduced by Nachtigall in 95, 10 years ago. And he proved the excellent gap estimates for the Heisenberg model, for the one-dimensional Heisenberg model. I'm going to write down two slides. If you have a gap, and also the decay of the gap if it's the isotropic model. Okay. And as I've heard the last 2 days, I mean, you care whether it's polynomial or exponential. We improved the estimates improved Nachtigall's estimates. So you wouldn't care about whether the constant is 2 or 1, but I mean, it's good to have sharp gap estimates. So some 2 years ago, we together with, well, 4 years ago, with Shannon, we improved the Martingale method and obtained sharp gaps for the Heisenberg model, for the one-dimensional Heisenberg model. It's a sharp gap, and it was, but because that was known before. But we also proved a gap estimate for the AKLT model, which is the AKLT model is a one-dimensional anti-ferromagnetic model. And I've stressed here anti-ferromagnetic, so this is, you wouldn't think that an anti-ferromagnetic model is frustration-free, but this special one is actually frustration-free. And AKLT stands for Affleck, Kennedy, Lieb, and Tosaki, and that's where all the VBS and the they are called matrix product states, where all these thing comes from. So that's an important model. So these are all translation variant models. And when I add a magnetic field, I destroy, I mean a local magnetic field, I destroy translation variants. So the method also works if you have non-translation variant, long-term sensing variance situation. How does the Nightingale method work? You have to know the ground states. Well, let's say you want to prove a gap, but at least you have to know the ground states. You have to know them sufficiently well. And it's a procedure that if you know, it's just about spin chains. If you know the ground states on L sites, right? And now you add one more site. How does the ground states change? And if you can estimate the change of the ground state, and if you know the gap for, say, for your two-site Hamiltonian, then you get an estimate for the L-site Hamiltonian. That's the procedure. Okay, I'm gonna be more precise than this, but that's, so to say, the method. It's an inductive step. So by the way, I have 10 transparencies. So we are at number 5 now. Okay, so this is now a little bit technical. Well, anyway, what is this about? So we consider a chain 0, 1, 2 of L sites. And now I want to cover this chain with some sub intervals. And there's two choices which come up in applications. And one is the natural, where you just take, you know, your subsystem being this, then this is the next interval, this is one interval, and this is the next interval, right? So this could be your choice, C0, C1, C2, and so on, right? So that the sum of all these intervals is just the whole chain. Well, that's one natural choice. You build up your chain by adding an interval to the right. Right. So this is one choice. That's a natural choice. Another choice, which is important for our case when we have a magnetic field, you should not start from here, but you should start where your magnetic field is localized, right? Because that pins you down the ground state. But so that's the second choice here. You should start somewhere in the middle, right? So I have here an X naught and a Y naught, and here is my L for L minus 1. Here is my 0. So this will be where my magnetic field will be localized, and I do something about this interval. And then I add something to the left, something to the right, and I build up the whole chain. So I have here some sets C, which have the property that you get the whole chain, but not more than that if you intersect two, and there is just one point in common. That's all. So you don't count them twice.
So is not uniform?
No, exactly. The magnetic field will not be uniform. If they're uniform, you can't move them. Right? So I wondered about that a lot. How do you move them? How do you write down a magnetic field that you can A, move this guy, and B, prove it? Because it's... So we will see conditions on V of T. But V of T will be something, so let me say right here. Well, it will be a magnetic field, which is, say, time dependent, and it will be a transversal, so in the one direction, because the Heisenberg model will be in the Z direction. OK, and it will be localized here, and so it's convenient to start building the chain from the inside. All right, so I had, and in general, On all of these subsets, I have a Hamiltonian, right? So I take here a CI, that's an interval, and then I have a local Hamiltonian.
Okay, can I just ask a question?
Sure.
You said the Heisenberg was in the Z.
Right.
But isn't the Heisenberg sigma down sigma?
Well, right. I take an anisotropic one.
Oh, so there's a difference.
Yeah. That's totally correct. That's totally correct. Because the isotropic one does not have stable interfaces.
Okay. Okay, so you're, it's an x, x equals y, y, and then z, z.
It's x, x, z, if you want. You know, you agree to this notation?
It's insane, but I know.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
I know what it means, but it's...
You mean x equals to y?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. I will write down the model, but this is just kind of abstract.
I just want to know.
Very good, very good. Okay, so we have these local intervals. You can think of just these consecutive intervals. Question, Sean?
Yes, the question is, when you have this local Hamiltonian,
yes,
are you saying that all the spin that are involved are only located in the side of CI?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what about the interaction between various CIs? Mm-hmm.
They overlap.
They only have one, so it's a two local interaction.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can I just think of it as the erratic spin?
Yeah, yeah. You will see the model in
two spins. So is it why you consider C1, which will correspond to the interaction between C0 and C and the rest?
Right. So so a Hamiltonian of this one will be, say, S0 dot S1, right, on this one. And then the next one, so they exactly they interact.
So the, so okay, so you these examples work if you have a two local.
Yeah, they're working. I'm only interested in two local Hamiltonians. Yeah. Okay, so I have local Hamiltonians which are small. Say you know, in this case 4x4 matrices for spin 1/2. Right. Here it's a little bit bigger, but it's always some finite dimensional matrix. And my total Hamiltonian is just the sum of all those. Huh? All right? Good. So now comes the conditions about. I mean, this is a this was some abstract notation. I need some conditions on these local Hamiltonians, and there is one which is not difficult to realize. So I call a quantum spin system being a frustration free if 1 and 2 are satisfied. Okay. So what does that mean? So 1 means that the local Hamiltonians are positive definite. So in the end, my total Hamiltonian is positive. Right? Well, that's of course, you can always shift stuff, right? But it's tied. It's tied to the second condition that the kernel of the total Hamiltonian is non-zero. Okay? So what does that mean? What does that mean? So let me say the following. 1 and 2 imply that the kernel of HL, which will be your ground state, right? Because HL is positive. So if you have something in the kernel, it's got to be a ground state. It has energy zero, right? If you have these two conditions, that the kernel of HL is just the intersection of all the kernels of the local Hamiltonians, right? The intersection of the kernels of all local Hamiltonians, which means if I have a C, which is a ground state on the whole chain, and if I restrict, right, if I restrict to a subsystem, I still have a ground state. It has to be, if it's a ground state, then it has to be here. It has to be also in all of those kernels. Right? That means frustration free. You have a quantum spin system, and you have a ground state on the whole system. If I reduce, it's still a ground state. It's not frustrated. Right? As compared to frustrated quantum spin systems. This is the condition of being frustration free. Comes from the home, it also minimizes the energy on the local system.
Is that if you give
you an arbitrary? Well, no, typically not. No, I mean, it's not a typical thing for a quantum spin interaction. But it is the case for these ferromagnetic Heisenberg models. It is the case. And there's lots of, I mean, you can transfer this to a, I mean, the it's equivalent. I mean, the Heisenberg model is equivalent to the simple exclusion process. If you have this anisotropy, it's equivalent to the asymmetric simple exclusion process. Well, you have a lot of, you know, probability. There's a lot of interest in the exclusion process, and the gap Dirac estimate is exactly equal to the rate of convergence to the equilibrium state. So these two are related. I mean, okay, oh, I have to say one more thing. I need to define some projections. So if I have here my chain, and suppose I have, and now I take a subsystem, say this is lambda, right? So a bunch of points. Then I define G lambda to be the orthogonal projection onto all ground states which fit into the systems, into the system. So I take here the local Hamiltonian, so the CIs, they all got to be in lambda, right? Take all of those, which fit into this interval, and I take the kernel of this, which means I project down onto all ground states. And this is my G lambda.
So that's the complement of the subset of the ground state, or something to that effect.
The complement?
No, it's exactly the ground state.
It's exactly the ground state.
What's orthogonal?
It's orthogonal projection. I mean,
oh, he's already talking. So.
Right, that's cheesy, but I mean, just to be.
Yeah, yeah. He just projects.
Orthogonal projection.
Well, what's the orthogonal projection?
I need the word orthogonal to tell you that he's exactly.
Oh, okay.
And the projection in general is just without being, I don't know.
So
it's taped, you know?
That's what we call a projection.
Yeah, it's just projection onto it, because otherwise people think you're taking the orthogonal complement. You just want to the projection onto the, since they're self-adjoint operators.
Okay. So this will be one thing. And then I also want, so this will be one projection, G lambda, and the other projection is E. And this E is the difference. So if you have, that's what I was saying before somehow, you have all the ground states on the system lambda I. Now you increase this a little bit, and you want to know how is the, and you want to know what is the difference to adding one more cycle. So to say, right? That is the difference of these two projections. This I call by EI. Okay. Because I don't expect you to memorize this towards the next slide, because then I will explain this again. Okay, so I define some projections. What else do I need?
The EI is not necessarily a projection.
But it turns out to be a projection.
It is.
Huh? It turns out to be a projection as well.
It is a projection.
Yep, it is a
projection. Because the kernel is actually decreasing over an I.
Okay, so
the G's commute.
They
commute. The EI is where it's not in the new kernel, it's in the previous one.
Very good. And so I need this G's and I need these E's to formulate the theorem, and I also need the gaps. So this little gaps, gamma I, will just be the gaps of the local Hamiltonians, right, say 4x4 matrices. So what I mean by this is that the local Hamiltonian is larger or equal to the gap times 1 minus the projection of the ground state. It's a fancy way of saying that. This is the gap. Okay, so what do I have? I have these projections, and I have these gaps of the local Hamiltonians. And in terms of these, I find a gap estimate. Okay, so I'll explain this again, but just let me formulate the theorem. So if the following is true. So just take the minimum of those gaps. They could be all the same, but just take the minimum of those gaps. And suppose that this minimum is positive, or anyway, I would have to trivial lower bound. So take the minimum of those gaps. And now take the norm of the product of two projections. I'll explain what that actually means, but just for the second, assume that the norm of these projections is less or equal than some epsilon, and this epsilon is less than 1 over root 2, which is critical. But anyway. Certain projections have norm less than 1 over root 2. Okay.
The product of these two projections.
Oh, yeah, that's always, that's right. Okay. A certain norm of two projections is less than 1 over root 2. Then I'm saying the following. If C is orthogonal to the ground states of the Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian, right? C is orthogonal to the ground state of the total Hamiltonian. And these ground states, they might not, they need not to be unique. You can have lots of them. It doesn't matter. Right? They could be degenerate. Just say that. So if that is true, then the expectation value of HL has to be larger equal to this number times C squared. And this is then the gap for the L side Hamiltonian. So what is that built up from? So it's built up from the gap of the two side Hamiltonian, see? And it's multiplied by a factor which is 1 minus 2 epsilon, this epsilon here, times root 1 minus epsilon squared. Okay? So you need to know the gaps of the local Hamiltonians. I mean, fair enough. You need to know how this. You need to know the norm of this projection. Then you get a formula for the gap of the many side Hamiltonian. And as I said, you can get the sharp gap estimate in the Heisenberg model, and a good one for the AKLT. Using this.
By sharping this precise estimate, or
that's right.
As opposed to the maximum.
No, that is sharp. So if the sharp, I mean, you can find an upper bound of the same. So I mean, I could have here a bigger one. I mean, this number could be bigger, right? Could be, I mean, in principle, you know.
Oh, so sharp means it's as good as you can do.
It's as good as you can do.
Does that just mean it's not an inequality? It's an equality?
No, there are some models for which it can be equal.
There are no examples where it's.
Okay.
Well, I mean, for the AKLT model, the exact gap is not
the best inequality.
Yeah, Sean?
Is this inequality depending only on the assumption, or is it not a dependent thing?
No. This is every time you have this.
It works.
Yeah. But, you know, as you point out, I mean, you need a frustration-free quantum spin system. I mean, there's a computer language for every problem. There's a method for, I mean, there's not a universal gap for any problem. But I'm saying that there's a class of interesting models where you can use this thing. Mm-hmm. Among them, the Heisenberg model, and the ferromagnetic Heisenberg model, and the AKLT model.
So can I?
Sure.
Another question. What you said is that these gap estimates gives you pretty sharp estimates when you compare with the real gap.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea why it's so good?
No. I mean, in other words, why in the AKLT model it's so bad? I don't know.
Okay. And what happens if epsilon gets smaller? I mean, then
it gets better.
Yes, but what does that mean for the models?
Not
I mean, that the as you said, I mean, if you
it's more or less the systems in various CIs are independent.
Yes,
that's what it means.
So it's
much better.
It's much
means
better.
It's a decoupling.
Yes, it's an almost decoupling, but the performance is different.
I mean, you could, if you want, to apply this to the easing model. And so this epsilon is equal to zero, then.
Are you telling me that it could work for models in two dimensions?
Well, in two dimensions, typically, you don't have, I mean, in principle, yes. But the question is, how do you build up?
I know examples where it could be applied.
So okay, I would be happy to apply it.
You could model the Isaac model for a finite system.
Yeah, the gap is one.
And you can.
Right, the gap is one. And then this epsilon, you can calculate explicitly. I mean,
no, what if you have a transverse field? I mean, an isomodel with a transverse field. If you have an isomodel with a transverse field,
yes.
Could you get the entanglements of the gap?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for example, for the, I mean, this looks like a number which is independent of, this looks like a number which is independent of L. Huh? It looks like. But if I take the isotropic ferromagnetic model, the gap goes down like 1 over L squared.
Yeah.
And this I also get, because then the epsilon depends on L.
So you think you
can
do this?
I can. I also get the decay. I mean, I also get decaying gaps. I mean, how do they really scale with the length of the chain? In my example of moving these domain walls, I have actually a positive gap, independent of L. Yeah.
So for instance, does that apply to the Aden chain with spin web?
The what?
The Aden chain.
Well, very good. So there is one famous conjecture that the spin one Heisenberg, the spin one isotropic antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model has a spin has a positive gap.
It's been shown by the DMRG actually very well.
In computing. Yeah, that's right. That's right. You can apply. Well, what is the problem? You have to know the ground state. I don't know the ground state.
Yeah, then.
Huh? Whole thing conjecture. Yeah. So I can't.
It's a conjecture.
So how many minutes do you have left? 14. Wow. All right. So I wanna repeat this picture. So but Sean was already pointing to what is this. What this number actually means, this number, I mean, this this norm of the projections, what does this mean? Okay, so what you do is you take your chain of I sites, and then you take a state C, which is a ground state on lambda I. But it can be anything on the other side. The ground state on this one can be anything. And then you take it, and then, but, we can see N, and C is orthogonal to the ground states on lambda I plus 1. Ground state here, but orthogonal to the ground states on the chain when I add one more site. And then I apply the projection. So here, this whole thing is lambda I plus 1, just adding one more site. And then on the last two sites, I calculate the projection onto the ground state of this local Hamiltonian. Right? This is a 4x4 matrix. So you know explicitly what you can diagonalize. You know this one. Right? And then you calculate the norm, which is exactly this one here, if you want to think about it. That's this norm. And if this norm, if this transition going from I site to an I plus 1 site Hamiltonian, if this transition is small enough, it turns out to be 1 over root 2, then the whole thing works. That's all. So that's what you have to do.
Is the ground state on it lives in where? In which Hilbert space?
Oh, in the total Hilbert space. Yeah. Very good. Okay, so now I think we are ready to apply this to the ferromagnetic Heisenberg model I was mentioning all the time. So what do we have? I have, first of all, what is called an anisotropy parameter, capital delta. That's bigger than 1, say. And then I will have, so I use these spin matrices. They are just by a factor 1/2 of your Pauli matrices. So S, and downstairs I use the lattice index, right? This X goes from 1 or from 0 to L. And upstairs, I have the directions, so x, y, and z for 1, 2, 3, right? So that's how I enumerate these things. And it's the usual spin 1/2 matrices that I'm going to use. OK, so now I just have a nearest neighbor interaction. So I take two nearest neighbors, x and x plus 1. And then my little Hamiltonian, my local Hamiltonian is what? It's the xx. Z. So I mean, in the one direction, it's just a product of these two matrices, and let us have x, x plus 1. The same for the y direction, x, x plus 1. Right? So I take the product of these matrices. And then I have the interactionals in the z direction. So the direction in the z direction is a little bit larger, right? So here I have a 1, and here I have a 1 over delta. Right? So as we were agreeing, this is x, x, z model. Okay, I shift this whole thing. So ferromagnetic means I have minus here all the time. Okay, so then I shift this whole thing by this harmless a quarter times the identity, just to get it positive. And then I have, so without this term here, this would be the usual ferromagnetic interaction, right? That would be the usual one. So I have here a little field. Namely, I have a field in the, let's see, so these two, so I have an x and an x plus 1. And I have, so here it's up. And here it's, so I have a field in the z direction, which points up here and down here, OK?
It's an order for the other positive.
It's, yeah, it's still positive. Allow me to add this for a second. Okay. In the end, I'm going to do the sum of all local Hamiltonians. So of course, I will have the sum of all of those. And this is a telescoping sum. Right? So in the end, I will, inside my chain, I will not see this field. I will just see a field which is up here on the first side, and on the last side, L minus 1, which is pointing down here. Right? So if you just think about, these two fields, or here and there, if you want to have a ground state, well, you better be, say, loosely speaking, you better be down here and up there. And if you also include, so twisted boundary conditions, if you want to. So if you now find the ground states, well, what you will see, I mean, the ground state of the total Hamilton, you will see these domain walls. You will see these states. So in order to have your ground state, you want to go something like this, right? So I add a little bit of, actually, there's a mismatch minus 2, but never mind. So I add this field, this boundary conditions. These are just boundary conditions. Then as ground states, I get actually a lot of them. I get a number of L plus 1 ground states. And they all have energy 0. And they describe domain wall states. So for every, total S3 component, like total S3 commutes with this Hamiltonian, for every one of those, I have a ground state. And they look like this. So if you go to a different sector, and it's like this. This is just the profile. This is the expectation diagram, right? So what I'm saying is you have these ground states. The Heisenberg model does have interface or domain wall states as ground states. And once you have them, you can start up, you can ask the question, how do I move these things around? And I move them around by adding a magnetic field, right? Here is just the estimate of the gap. So what Coleman Nachtigall estimated in 95 was the gap above these ground states, which is 1 minus 1 over delta cosine of pi over L. And this is sharp, so you can't do better than this. And you see, if L goes to infinity, I have a uniform positive gap, 1 minus 1 over delta. If I have the isotropic model, which means delta is equal to 1, right, I don't have this term, so the isotropic ferromagnetic Heisenberg model, then the gap decays, if you play with this, gap decays like 1 over L squared, or pi L squared, pi over L squared, right? So this is sharp, and this can prove. It's also, the Martingale method is also very useful to prove gaps in the infinite volume limit, which is a subtle business. I mean, you don't care about this because, well, maybe you do, but this is very subtle because the infinite volume gap, I'm just taking here the infinite volume limit, just formally, the infinite volume gap need not to be equal to the gap, to the limit of the finite volume gaps. Huh? You cannot just take, I mean, in many cases it works, you cannot just take the finite volume gap and take the limit as L goes to infinity. It need not to work. The gap can be larger, bigger, and in most cases actually equal. So this is subtle, but the Martingale method actually helps you to decide this question. All right. Question? So here are my time. How many?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, huh?
In what sense would you, I mean, then you have to define your model in the limiting
exactly.
The first place.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
You need to work with it. Question?
I don't understand why there's a gap. I mean, one thing is that the where the spin is not in the z minus z direction, it's in the x to y direction.
Well, this is a lot of energy.
You've broken, so you give me a ground state, and I think I can find another ground state. So to me, that means there's a zero energy state of some sort.
Oh yeah, this is zero. This has zero energy because I mean I've just arranged my terms.
Oh, so
the energy is zero.
Do you need ground state?
No, it has. You see, all of them. Well, the reason for this is the quantum group symmetry. I don't want to answer in this, but I mean.
So you're happy with this more than one ground state?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. Large, and then the infinite volume limit, I have a ground state which is infinitely degenerate, and above that I have a gap, which is this number 1 over 1 minus 1 over delta. So I can have a lot of ground states, and still it works. Okay, so just a little bit of assumptions on my magnetic field. You see, I'm interested in large lattices, because my domain will maybe overlap. So I keep the magnetic field being not being spread out too much. So if L goes to infinity, if the size goes to infinity, my support of the magnetic field stays fine. That's a mild assumption. So that's this one, and it's gonna be transversal, and it has to be, it's in a certain direction. You don't have to be that strict. But anyway. I assume something about the magnetic field. Okay, and then the Hamiltonian is just the sum of these two Hamiltonians, and it can make sense in the infinite volume limit if you want to. There's no problem with that. And now I claim the following. So if there is no magnetic field, then I have a lot of ground states, like L plus one, right? And they are all like this, somewhere linear combinations, whatever. If I have a magnetic field, and say just a magnetic field at one point, transversal, then it selects one of those ground states, and it will select. So if I have a magnetic field in this direction, it will select this one because that has z component zero. So it's probably that it has a lot of component in the x direction, and that's what's happening. So if you add a magnetic field in this direction, then this is the unique ground state of the sum. It selects a unique one. Right? They all have a little bit higher, and this was the starting point. So if you have a magnetic, so in the initial Hamiltonian, you have a magnetic field which is exactly sitting here, and in the end of the day, your magnetic field will be sitting there. So you have moved adiabatically this domain will over to there. And all you have to do is estimate the gap if you have a magnetic field like this. Hmm? And the theorem, I put down the theorem, maybe that's the last thing I'm going to say. So under the above assumptions, I have a unique ground state. And this unique ground state has a strictly positive gap uniformly in L. And then I have no problem applying the adiabatic theorem. In applications, you're of course interested. How does the gap depend on the magnetic field? It's interesting. And how does it depend on the anisotropy? That's the coupling constant in the Hamiltonian. You can do certain things. You can do analytically, and the rest you do numerically to see how it works. And that's it. The only thing I want to say about this proof is that. Having a unique ground state is just Perron Frobenius. Right? So, which would fail if you wouldn't have this SX, which brings you in different, which mixes all these different sectors. Right? So, getting a unique ground state is application of Perron Frobenius, But that does not tell you that the gap is sort of how the gap behaves, let's put it this way. So, and then, can disappear, you need ground state. So then you have to work with the Martingale method, and you build these intervals up starting from the middle, so where the magnetic field is localized, and then you add and build up the whole chain. And that's how you prove this. Chuck?
Isn't that the more precise rephrasing of what was said before with these conductance methods for the estimated magnetic?
Well, let's put it this way. Well, I said I claim that I can prove that I can show it explicitly the gap. Well, so they estimate the gap of the Laplacian, which we have seen, plus a potential, plus a delta potential.
You don't need to.
And everybody can do that using transfer matrices. You can explicitly solve the whole spectrum.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's just.
It's straightforward. I don't need to. I mean, the advantage was I learned about these methods.
Yeah, that's but why they put that in fairness to that. I think they know it can be done simply, and they wanted to just do it by a different way. It is overkill, but I think they.
It is overkill.
But they wanted to just kind of show enough method. That's why I was.
So you agree that one can explicitly.
Oh, I'm happy. Well, maybe we can continue the discussion over lunch.
Thank you.